Hi everyone, this is Asiel Altaeva, and welcome to another episode of the FEMES Finance Podcast, where we explore the journeys of successful female leaders, founders, and investors from across the globe. We aim to champion women leaders from diverse sectors and industries in order to inspire you in your journey to financial freedom and career success. Thank you for listening to the FEMES Finance Podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the FMS Finance Podcast. This is your host, Asiel. And today, I'm super excited to be joined by Alana Karen, who is an award-winning tech leader, author, and speaker. With more than 25 years in tech, including over two decades at Google, Alana worked across search, ads, Google Fiber, and Google Grants, helping to build products and teams that touched billions of people worldwide. She's also the author of Adventures of Women in Tech, now releasing a brand new second edition that explores how our work, culture, and careers are shifting in the AI era. Beyond her incredible career, Alana is also passionate about inclusive leadership, sustainable careers, and helping people navigate constant change. In this conversation, we'll talk about her journey inside Google, what it takes to thrive, her thoughts on big tech, layoffs, and culture shifts, and how women can build both financial and career resilience in today's fast-moving technological era. So, Alana, it's so great to see you again on our podcast. We last spoke about 2 years ago. How have you been since then, and what has changed for you personally and professionally?
Well, it's great to be back. Thank you so much for having me. And I guess the big thing is that I left Google. I left Google last November, and I've been spending this year writing, doing some creation of video, doing some coaching, kind of a little bit of everything, and exploring what it means to be in the outside world. So that's been pretty exciting for me. I have teenagers now, one who's still like grade school, but I have three kids. And so just feeling like we're all moving along in our lives and trying to really embrace this period of change.
Beautiful. I guess me and also our listeners are interested to know what actually convinced you that it was time to leave Google after working there for almost like 20 years.
Yeah, I had really thought about it over time. I'd never been the type of person who knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I'd had to really check in with myself along the way in my career to see whether I was still enjoying my work. Was I still learning? Was I still feeling challenged? And I got into this regular rhythm of at least once a year, kind of asking myself these questions to figure out, am I personally on track, given I'm not aiming for some particular North Star? I need a check-in mechanism to make sure that I'm making myself change if it's time to change. And over the last couple of years, I started to really see that because of various things, my learning had slowed down and I wasn't seeing a lot of opportunity ahead of me. It was just feeling like time for a change. And I explored some different things internally, but like ultimately just felt like my path was leading me to wrap up my journey at Google. I think it took me a little bit of time, actually. Like I think I was feeling it a lot during the last couple of years. I think it took me a little bit of time to ultimately really come to peace with that and wrap up my time. But I will say, I think because I went through that journey, I'm feeling really good about it. I don't have regrets. I felt like I left the way I wanted to at a good time. And now I'm just really interested in what's next.
I want to ask, do you have a specific system that helps you to make those kind of decisions? If you have a special system, can you please walk us through that and how it actually helps you?
So in the Adventures of Women in Tech workbook, I basically simulated what I'd done for myself years ago, thinking through what things were most important to me, and then crafting questions that I would ask myself on a regular basis, at least once a year, for me, but sometimes when there were major shifts at work. And so for me, what was really important was learning. And so one of my questions was, are you still learning? Another thing that was important to me was being able to see the next year's worth of challenges. And so I had a question of like, can you see what you would do like for the next year? What's your next challenges? Another one that was really important to me was, are you having fun? Am I enjoying my work? Like work enjoyment was really fun. So I just asked myself that question. Also, I knew that who I worked with was really important to me. So I asked, do you like who you work with? So it was a really easy four question thing. Now, you might have something different, which is like, if you know you have a goal, yours might be very much more goal oriented. Like, do you see this as a clear step to your goal? Do you see a clear path to your goal from where you are? If you're really money oriented, it might be about like, do you see the next salary raise or promotion? So the things that motivate you might be different and they may change over the course of your life. But mine were pretty solid. And those four questions worked for years. Honestly, I think I started them, I don't know, 10 to 15 years before. Ultimately, I felt like, okay, now I see that the answers are leading towards me wanting to leave Google versus making a change in my job.
I wonder if you're considering to apply for a different role and at different companies, or perhaps create your own startup. Are you considering those options? Because you're also based in Silicon Valley, I guess there are many exciting projects and exciting companies
that
you can work on. So I wanted to ask your perspective.
I did, before I left Google, apply for a last job. It was at my level, but it had more responsibility. So it would have been seen as a real step up. And it would have been a really nice capstone overall. It probably would have been as senior as I got at Google. And it would have been a nice challenge and a capstone to my career. But I also kind of had it in mind that it was a competitive role. I might not get it. And if I didn't, I was up or out. So for me, I wasn't looking around, but I kind of knew. I knew exactly what it would be worth to stay. And if I didn't end up getting the role, which I didn't, a lovely colleague did, then I would leave. And when I left, I wanted a break. Because I really felt like after 25 total years, because I had a couple jobs before Google in tech roles, that I just was pretty burnt out. I wasn't as excited as I should be about things that other people were excited about. Like AI was exciting a lot of people. And I was just like, it's another thing. I think the relentless rhythm of tech and almost the relentless need to be excited and advance to the next thing. And also the organizational toll it had taken on me as Google grew and we had to keep growing and shifting and reworking and all of these types of things. At the end of the day, I think like, I don't want to go anywhere else. It's not that I want to go anywhere else. I can't imagine being in another room with different people and enjoying it. I like these people, but I'm not growing in this way anymore. I think I could go down the entrepreneur path. You talked about startup. I don't fancy so much a tech startup, but I have sort of been building my own business here with the writing, coaching, consulting, etc. We'll see whether I end up ever feeling like doing more. At this point, there's actually something just so simple about being my own boss and getting to decide what I do each day and keeping it actually a bit more personal and intimate that I'm loving, absolutely loving. After years of cross-organization negotiation and navigation and having to get hundreds of people bought into every little thing, you know, if I decide to change the color of my website tonight, I can do it. Sometimes there is something simple about that. Now, I do want to say, and we'll get to some finance talk later, that I had to work for years to be able to afford this break. Just a disclaimer that I think often and earlier in my career, I would have felt like I had to look for something else. The way that I had navigated my career and how I'd saved up over the years, I was able to take this break. And yay, because I really needed it, as it turned out.
Great. You touched upon your current responsibilities, which includes writing and coaching. So your first book, Adventures of Women in Tech, came out a few years ago. And I want to ask, what shifts have you seen since then that you decided to write a fully updated, the second version of it? What is new there? What did you write about? Can you please walk through that?
Absolutely. So yeah, the first book was called The Adventures of Women in Tech, How We Got Here and Why We Stay. And I wrote that 5-6 years ago, feeling very much concerned about a growing message on news, in the market, that like, ooh, maybe it was like too tough for women, right? The hashtag MeToo era had come, and now there were all these articles about how toxic workplaces were. The overall tone was a little bit more like, maybe women shouldn't come to tech because it's too hard, not here's what we have to change to make it better. I was really annoyed by that. Looking around, I saw all of these women who had thrived in tech. And yes, it was hard, but they'd made it and they'd made a lot of money. And all different backgrounds, all different careers, all different kind of ambitions and origin stories. And so I wanted to write that book. So the first book was very much about belonging. And if you were in tech and feeling a little lost, or you were joining and you just needed this like group of women to hear their stories and tell them that it was possible, also why it was hard and how you navigate, that was the original impetus. Then you fast forward 5 years, and I felt like it was a very different environment where here were these very big companies, well, everything from big companies to startups, pursuing AI really wholeheartedly. And that was exciting on one hand, but it was also leading a major investment in machines and a reduction in people. So you're seeing lots of layoffs. There were other things that tied with this. There was a decline in users and usage after COVID. There was a difference in everything from how much you could borrow and at what rates. And so there were all kinds of reasons that went into a really big shift from an era during COVID where employees were able to get like amazing offers and there were jobs everywhere, to all of a sudden declining jobs and a real environment where bosses were calling the shots because now there were fewer jobs and there was this threat that AI might get you out of a job and costs were rising globally. And particularly in the US, we've had high inflation, but depending where you are, generally costs have been rising. And so you kind of got, all of a sudden, it went from a market where these companies had to compete for talent to a market where they had a bevy of talent and they could call you back to the office after a big hybrid period. They could ask you to work around the clock, work harder. They could change the performance management systems and make them hard, right? Like all of a sudden, huge shift. And I was feeling, not just for women, but because I'd written this book for women, that I had a big chapter missing, a big chapter about how would you navigate that? How would you change that? And that it might not necessarily be about you anymore. It would be about, do you need tech? Do you want tech? How do you navigate tech in this new manifestation that is so different from what you joined? And I thought no matter what, whoever you were reading it, if you'd gone through it, you might like a little bit of group therapy. So the chapters very much read in a little bit of like, this is what we went through. This is what happened. This is why it happened. And now what do we do about it?
I wanted to ask also about the title. You call this a hard tech era. How would you explain that?
Yeah. So now the subtitle is Navigating the Hard Tech Era. Newspapers had started to call, this was popularized by a New York Times writer, as I recall, this era of companies investing heavily in hardware and other systems to enable AI and things like cybersecurity, and a de-investment in people, a real changing in culture and corporate practices of these tech companies that had previously been sort of like havens with bouncy balls and lava lamps, right? This feeling that is like majorly shifted is not just feeling, it's a reality when you look at the numbers. And so it's been christened this idea of hard tech era. It's a little bit niche, meaning I've seen it in news articles, but I thought it so perfectly encapsulated. I decided to use it because I thought it so perfectly encapsulated that this does feel hard. And it feels hard in a different way than tech felt hard in the past. Tech always felt hard as an employee because it was so round the clock. The jobs were often demanding. There was a lot of do it faster, do it different. So it was never an easy road. But this feeling now that maybe no matter what you do, your employer might just cut you. no matter what you do, you might not get the big payout because maybe companies are at the point where they don't give as much stock, or even if you're a startup, they end up doing something where the employees don't get paid out. All of these kinds of things are happening. And I do think that it can feel hard in a different way and unrewarding and difficult. So yeah, this hard tech era.
I guess we could talk about layoffs. There have been waves of layoffs in big tech companies in the last few years. What are your thoughts about layoffs? You've already shared a little bit about what's really driving those cuts. And I just want to know your thoughts about it. And also, what does it signal about where the industry is headed?
My thoughts are, I guess I have a few different ones, of course. I try to give short answers. And then I'm like, well, that's really a multi-layered question. I don't like them. Like, I mean, obviously, it's very hard on an organization to recover any sense of psychological safety, to get people back to focusing on good, positive work and not just constantly fearful for their jobs. We as humans aren't great when we're scared because we do a lot of fight, flight, freeze behaviors, like very instinctual behaviors that really aren't conducive to higher level thought in the workplace. And so you end up producing more political environments, more hostile environments, because everyone's afraid and feeling heightened feelings of competition and worry. So I don't love them as a general practice. Now, I will say that I think from a business perspective, it was probably something that was going to happen because tech had hired in such an unrestrained manner, especially during COVID, for the demand of the period. Then the demand sharply dropped and you had a lot of people that you really no longer needed. So that was, you know, some people would call it a mistake. Other would call it, you know, the kind of thing that you see in retrospect, like you didn't know that would happen. You know, could you, did you really overhire? Was it really a mistake? But in any way, it was sort of the kind of thing that probably from the minute we started to hire too much was bound to have to happen. I think it was really hard for people to understand that even if your company has a lot of money in the bank, you don't continue to run a business that bleeds money. So you don't just like use that money to pay for employees that revenue isn't covering, right? If you are not making money, you should cut employees. And so I think that was a really hard, like tough love, big business capitalism answer that took a lot of people in tech by surprise because it had felt like that's not how it was run. And even some companies promised not to do layoffs and then later did them. And again, I think it was a lesson that the CEOs to some degree had to learn as well. You can be morally opposed to them. You can be trying everything else to forestall them. But ultimately, if you have more people than revenue is bringing in, it is likely what you would have to do. I think what it says about tech is that it got really mature. It's got grown up big company problems. And it's very much, especially for the public companies, dominated by a lot of capitalism. The minute these companies' revenues dropped, shareholders clamored. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Cut your people, cut the workforce. And that's a very different problem set than if you're a small business owner and you're not making enough, right? If you bootstrapped, you'll figure out what to do just in and amongst yourself. Very different when you've got thousands and thousands of employees and you're investors are losing faith. The major companies carry the NASDAQ in the US. The major tech companies essentially make over 50% of the earnings of the NASDAQ. So you are going to deal with some real world painful issues, and layoffs are part of that.
I wanted to ask about AI because we've already talked about it. How do you think which roles will thrive, which will shrink, and how do we future-proof our careers?
Yeah, it's one of those things where time will tell. I think some of the initial talk is always a little overblown. I don't think that we usually know exactly what will happen. If I think back to when I was in college, the big thing, it was like the dot-com era. And so, like, how was the internet? How are all of these new companies going to take the place of traditional businesses? And I think it took a while to shift, but I'm sure you could look back and find articles that basically was like, no one will shop at brick and mortar stores anymore. Everyone will stay in their house and just order from these companies, right? Like, there was a lot of fear mongering, and some of it did happen, but not all of it. And there still is a human impetus to get out and shop in person. There's still a preference for many industries to do so. While many companies have been able to grow and build on this new platform, humans have adjusted. And in fact, there are things we didn't even guess. Social media, tiny phones, like, we didn't guess any of these at the time. So there's a lot we don't know. So going back to AI, I think what I've really focused on telling people to thrive right now is that knowing that the technology can replicate simple rote tasks. And yes, there are some things that you wouldn't even consider simple that it can do, but generally the best way to kind of group it is that it is very good at sort of the math and science of things. If it is calculatable, if you can put it into rows in a database, if you can make it make sense, catalog it, turn it into a spreadsheet, turn it into a list of things, assess it, summarize, it's very good at that. It is not good at on-the-fly adaptation to situations, to emotions. It is not good at rapidly evolving situations often because it's only as good as what it's been trained on. It is not yet good really at robotics. There are robotics companies. They often do well on very specific cases. They are solving a lot of complicated problems in terms of how you actually deal with, again, a world which constantly changes around you. Watching a robot try to hold a tray just shows you how much human evolution has done over thousands of years to let us hold a tray. And so a lot of physical jobs or jobs that require some physical element, I think, are also longer term. There are some specialized medical use cases, of course, where robots are better, like lasers and stuff like that. And I hope we continue to pursue those add-on cases versus human replacement cases, places where technology augments what humans can do, not where it necessarily replaces them. But we kind of, again, have to see how that develops. What I will say is that behind every single decision, there's money. So if you become a niche expert in a field, it is very unlikely that you can be replaced because it is very expensive to train anything uniquely on expert and niche, particularly if there's a physical component. So I am mostly right now encouraging people to learn more, get deeper. If you were someone who was just learning basic engineering and you thought you were going to get a job, well, yeah, maybe now you're going to struggle a little bit more. They're hiring less entry-level engineers because they believe they can use AI. They believe. We'll see. Okay. We'll see how well that works out for everybody. But surely it has from the data, reduced jobs in that field. So what are you going to do to get some real world experience to get deeper into a particular field or experience niche to build out to specialize so that you are a bit more? Will you take a lower paying job at first in order to build out that experience so then you could parlay it somewhere? Would you continue to study so you can be an expert in a field from a research studies point of view? There are still options. It's just that this really changed the market for a lot of entry level positions right out of the gate, right out of especially college, because a lot of that stuff that you would do at first that was a little bit more grunt work and replicatable now potentially could be done cheaper by AI. And the last thing I'll just say is anywhere where emotional sensitivity is required will probably lag as well. Lots of people are trying to teach machines tone. It's tricky. I think it will do well enough at certain customer service cases, but I think that it probably won't on very, very sensitive matters, whether it's in medical fields or other types of sensitive situations. So I think depending where you're looking for those places where it's actually a human touch is actually required. Jobs where trust is a huge factor because people just do not form trusting relationships with machines usually or as well. Or just really good things to look at as you look for your jobs.
Right. You have a lot of experience and also working inside Google. What did you learn about compensation, equity, and just negotiating that people in general don't know, or perhaps they should know, but often they don't?
I think it sometimes takes people a while to realize how companies work, that generally companies have levels, and every level for every job type is associated with a salary band, a bottom salary that they're offer and a top salary. Often when you go in and you're either trying to negotiate for a raise or you're negotiating during an offer stage, what they're really trying to do is keep you within the band. And if they've already offered you a certain level, you might be capped out because they only want this job to be at that level and they only want to pay you this much. And trying to negotiate above that can be quite difficult because they'll just be like, no. Now, there are places where maybe you were given a lower number within the band. You probably won't know what the band is, honestly, but then you might be able to get a little bit more because you're lower in the band and they're willing to be like, okay, yeah, we'll throw you an extra little bit. Big companies like Google, over time, for fairness, started to basically say for a lot of roles, if you're a new L5, this is what you get. And it's only later, as you go through the performance process, that you might start to differentiate because your performance leads to different salary increases at companies that are merit-based. And then there is an annual salary review process where that performance gets taken into account. So I think what I would say is, number one, you should always, if they didn't hit the number that you wanted, you should always try to negotiate. But at the end of the day, how much you get or whether you get may be very much tied into these levels and bands that aren't usually published, but some companies guess at them. Levels.fyi gives some info on big companies. So you can do a little bit of research, but you'll have some trouble really knowing. Once you're inside, continuing to work with manager and having your manager know that you are motivated by compensation, what part of compensation motivates you most, salary, stock, equity, or bonus as applicable in your company. I think that often takes people time and they don't think they have seniority to talk about these things with their manager. But I think I would start fairly early, especially if it really matters to you to build future equity or it really matters you to increase salary so you can get a mortgage or whatever it is in your particular environment.
Yeah, it actually made me interested to know, how do you think when is the right time to talk about it? I feel like most of the times people are passive in this. They think that if they work hard, the manager will notice. And so what is your thoughts like? What is the best time to ask? What's the best approach to take?
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you the rhythm that I got into that I do think was good. And it really has to be customized for your company. But there were two main moments where I felt like the door was open for this kind of marketing. Number one is whatever the performance system is, really participate in how you are reviewed. So even if the company says you don't need to write anything up, your manager takes care of it. Even if they say you only need to write a little bit, whatever it is, do your best to still manage your manager and be like, hey, I know you have to write this up. Just a reminder, here's the five things I accomplished this year. If you know it's not supposed to be a lot, it could be short bullets. If you know promotion is coming up and he has to write a huge doc, maybe you write more, right? It really depends on your internal process. But I very much encourage managers to do their writing and know their employees. Still, no one knows better than you what you got done. And if you aren't tracking that for yourself in some way, shape, or form, if you're just trusting that someone else is collecting the numbers, I would keep some light track of like what you've launched, what you've completed, so that you could write something like this for yourself. At worst, if you were to get like instantaneously laid off, you would have the data to be able to use it for your resume. So that's the real doomsday scenario, but that's a good plan B reason to do this. So keep track of it, use it. You don't have to constantly do it, although I do think a lot of people use regular one-on-ones to keep reinforcing how awesome they are with their manager and keep them updated and really build a relationship with their manager where there is that constant communication. But certainly at this point, when it's time to review you, maybe give you a rating, determine your salary, you want them to know what you did and how it was great and what impact it had for the company. So don't just write, I got this done, write why it was important for the company and it increased revenue by X percent, for example. The second time is, it might be at the same time as that, it might be at a different time of year. Know if there is a cyclical time where salaries are reviewed. At Google, there was a cyclical annual review and it was a good time to go into your manager and say, hey, I know that's coming up. When you're doing this, I just want you to know that I really care about stock. That's what most motivates me. Or I know I came in on the low end of L5, and I think my work has proven that I'm worthy of more. I'd love to see myself moving up, right? So some things like that. And I think it's totally appropriate. And I just would do it at a logical time. It was really hard to me at companies like Google, where there really was only that one time a year, where when people would come at a totally different time of year and tell me they were disappointed with what they made, because I honestly had very little ability to do anything. So I think that if you can synchronize it as much as possible, that is when I would do it.
What is your last words of advice for our listeners to this podcast?
I think that as I look at this particular era, I'm actually feeling, it's really funny, when I wrote the chapters, the first couple chapters, they're very focused on what has changed and why that wasn't great for employees, why it was hard for a lot of users to trust these big companies, all of these kinds of things. And while it was like very good intellectually to get my arms around it, it wasn't driving me to get all perky. But as I started to write my third chapter, which is really about what we can do about it, whether we decide to stay, whether we decide to change jobs, whether we decide to leave tech, I started to feel really positive. And so I guess my final advice is, this is actually like an incredible environment to think about innovation. And if you're not finding those opportunities at the big companies, maybe it is a great time to look at smaller companies or even things that you would do yourself. Because in an environment where it doesn't feel safe to work for a big company anyway, it doesn't guarantee you the kind of upside that people felt like was guaranteed in the past, maybe it's a great time to bet on yourself. And I loved this idea that maybe this would be the next bed of innovation. Just like the internet movement had all of this innovation, maybe this AI hard tech era is the next big one in tech. And so I ended up talking myself into being re-excited about tech, even as I thought I was writing about all these hard things.
Amazing. Alana, last question, very short. Can you please recommend us three books to read?
When people ask me my favorite business book, I say Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. it's not really supposed to be a business book. It's Tina Fey writing about her experience on Saturday Night Live, but it gave me some of the best business advice that I've ever had working in an environment like SNL. So I suggest that. I recently read Die with Zero by Bill Perkins, which I think is a really interesting take on how much we delay living our lives for work and for saving up money. And should we be thinking about this economically quite different and about how we enjoy our lives? So I suggest that one. And a third one would be my book, of course. My book. Why am I thinking this hard? Read Adventures of Women in Tech, Navigating the Hard Tech Era, out in November.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Alana. Where can listeners connect with you and get their hands on the new edition of the book? Where they can order, when it will be available? Great. Can you please share?
I've got information on that at alanakaren.com, including a pre-order link. So feel free to visit and add your name to that list. And I will, of course, post more information on LinkedIn and Instagram if you follow me there. So please be in touch. I love hearing from listeners and connecting and learning more.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, Alana, for this great podcast episode. It was really nice to have you on our podcast and also discuss about different and really hard topics as layoffs. And so thank you so much for your time. We really enjoyed it.
And
yeah, the first thing that we're going to do is order your book on your website. So I've attached the link on the description below, and you can also find the link on LinkedIn. And I hope that you'll enjoy this book. Thank you so much for listening till the end.
Thank you for listening to the FEMA's Finance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform, such as Spotify and iTunes. Thank you for always supporting us. Enjoy your day.